under development is a transitory process that produces both modernity and inequality, as opposed to the expectant waiting in a primitive state of nature implied by the notion of being undeveloped. By framing colonialism as an impeded dialectical process in which the development of the wealth of Europe is predicated upon the underdevelopment of the Third World, Fanon helps to demonstrate how the question of nature, rather than being external or inimical to postcolonial critique, is actually foundational to it. If posing the question of nature can lead to a more adequate understanding of capitalism and colonialism from a planetary perspective, then in turn questions of structural inequality inherent to capitalism and colonialism can lead to a more adequate understanding of what nature means materially and epistemologically. I'm thinking here of a striking moment in the Eco-Criticism Reader where Neil Everenden raises the question of what it means to think environmentally. Everenden asserts, "One who looks on the world as simply a set of resources to be utilized is not thinking of it as an environment at all. The whole world is simply fodder and feces." I love that phrase, fodder and feces, to the consumer, in sharp contrast to the man who is in an environment in which he belongs and is of necessity a part. At first glance, this assertion may seem unobjectionable, except perhaps in gender terms, relying as it does on a seeming opposition between the unenlightened consumer, whose only interest in nature is its standing reserve of things he can use and throw away, as opposed to environmental man, who recognizes himself in a constitutive and deeply historical interrelationship with nature. Yet I want to suggest that Everenden's easy dismissal of mere resources, mere fodder and feces, is implicitly dependent upon his privileged position within a structure of global inequality in which the question of resources and access to them, or vulnerability to the aftermath of their extraction, the question of food security, the question of disposal of feces and other waste has been asked and answered for him in such a way that his own daily survival is not so much on the line. As one of my students has written, "I, person of the first world, typically don't see trash. I put trash in opaque black plastic bags or untransparent blue bins for recycling, and I usually never see it again. It goes to the dump, the landfill, etc." But the etc. is key because it reveals the etc. logic of displacement by which waste management operates. Trash only becomes trash when I find it in a place that is not here. Turning the idea of fodder and feces on its head in this way takes us back to Buell and his concern about the unconcern of the non-white male. What counts as environmental concern? What counts as environment? What counts as nature? These questions should suggest that the task of postcolonial eco-criticism does not consist merely in widening the lens to include previously excluded or overlooked geographical regions, historical experiences, cultural perspectives, questions of race, class, and gender, those of, say, the non-white male. Rather, the excavation of the politics of knowledge that, following the seminal work of Edward Said, has been one of postcolonial studies' most important interventions, might lead postcolonial eco-critics to question the very notion of what constitutes nature, environment, or ecological crisis. Indeed, David Maisel has borrowed Said's critique of Orientalism in order to make a simple yet urgently necessary statement. What comes to count as the environment is that which matters to the culturally dominant. Recognizing the constructiveness of concepts of environment or nature would help to make explicit the significance of the ecocentric assumptions in Buell's statements about non-white males being unmoved by the idea of, in his words, self-sacrificial caring for nature as an intrinsic good. If what counts as nature is constituted by relations of power, then we might come to recognize some of the claims of ecocentrism as being inflected by a certain ethnocentrism. Vandana Shiva asks us to move beyond the ecocentric and anthropocentric debate and to recognize the indivisibility of struggles for sustainability and peace, and struggles against what she calls ecological poverty for the poor, ecological poverty for the planet and economic poverty for the poor. If folding together these questions of nature, capitalism, and colonialism generates a different understanding of just what nature or an environment is, then it can also lead us to recognize dangers of an environmental ethnocentrism blind to its own relationship to these histories of violence. The Gospel of Green bears an ambivalent relationship to earlier Gospels disseminated from the West. To the varying extent, the disseminationist environmentalism's focus on problems of overconsumption, industrial pollution, or other aspects of capitalism's externalization of nature, the Gospel of Environmentalist Green may contradict, if not explicitly challenge, earlier Gospels of capitalist Green, if we can take green for a moment as the color of money rather than nature. We need only look back to the agricultural technology transfers of the mid-20th century for a cautionary example of how the West promised a better life for all through mastery of nature, including pesticides, fertilizer, irrigation, corporate-controlled seeds, and monoculture. This process, of course, went by the name of the Green Revolution. It is the under-examined tensions among these Gospels of Green that have allowed China and India, powerhouses of the developing world, to be invoked as scapegoats in U.S. political discourse on the difficulty of negotiating international climate change treaties. One of the seemingly non-environmental questions that has most troubled me as a post-colonialist is the relevance of mid-20th century national liberation struggles to the present moment.